Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. On this week's edition, we get an intimate look into the collaborative relationship between Ohio native Molly Wismeyer and Baton Rouge-born Adam Seeger. This dynamic duo talks with us about the visionary assistance they provided for the wine and cocktail program at Restaurant Revolution. Then, we'll have a Prohibition history lesson from award-winning documentarian Ken Burns. All that and a word from our new North Louisiana roving reporter, Shreveport's Chris J. Let's raise a glass and toast to another heady edition of Louisiana Eats. Iowan with an undergraduate degree in Russian may seem like an unlikely candidate for an aspiring sommelier, but not if you're Molly Wismeyer. Unlikely paths are something she shares with Baton Rouge native Adam Seeger, one of the world's most renowned bar chefs and a master sommelier in his own right. Here to talk about their collaborative history in some of our nation's most renowned restaurants are Molly and Adam. Welcome.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Poppy.
Very exciting to be with you.
Well, it's welcome back for Adam, but we're thrilled to have you on the show finally, Miss Molly. So you've been here in New Orleans long enough. It's about time.
2 years now.
So Rick Tramonto and his new restaurant with John Fultz, Revolution, is the tie that brought you both to New Orleans. So tell me a little bit about this collaborative process and how you all worked on this together.
Well, really, to go back briefly, if I may, yes, Adam and I were both really aspiring sommeliers in Chicago, and there was a tasting group where we were practicing for our classes. And it's important to mention that it was a meeting of the minds, destiny almost, because the people that were in the group, and Adam was one of them, we were all really focused on studying and learning more. We were driven by learning, which is brings me to why we're here in this Restaurant Revolution project, because originally Chef Tramonto had called me, it was in the spring of 2010, and said, oh, there's a possibility of a project in New Orleans, and with Chef John Fultz, you have to read about Chef John Fultz, go to his site, and he gave me his website and everything, and I was like, okay, great, Chef, no problem. At the time, I was working for Chef Charlie Trotter. So the first thing I did is I went to him and I said, there's a project possibly with Chef John Fultz in New Orleans, and Chef Trotter's response was, oh, fabulous. He's an icon. He's like, what is it? What would you be doing? And I said, well, they want me to come and build this a cellar. It's very substantial. It's a great opportunity. And, you know, Chef John Fultz, to me, seems like an icon. And he said, you absolutely have to go and do that, Molly. I said, that means I'm leaving Chicago. And he goes, absolutely, you have to go do that. It would be fabulous. Now, how that ties in with Adam is that it's safe to say, Adam, we've grown up together in the business.
How many years ago was it that you all were in that original tasting group?
We started that with Fernando Batetta, who's now a master sommelier, and a number of young folks who have really kind of gone on, done great things. And that would have been about 2003. Yeah. So coming up on 10 years.
Wow, yeah. That is a long time.
And it's been really neat with Molly now getting into the cocktail world, but coming at it from a sommelier perspective, which is really where I came in to the cocktail world. And it's neat for us to both be able to speak the wine language and try and transfer that into spirits. And then Molly is also, I'm quite jealous that she's got all these neat things that Chef Fultz is making with the ratafias and whatnot at her disposal, which is kind of a nice toy box also.
Well, before you all came here and started working on this project, what were some of the other projects that you all worked on in other places? Tell me about those.
Predominantly just tasting and learning. We didn't formally work together. but we were roommates in what we call the sommelier real world house. There were three sommeliers, and there was always some very fine wine open 24/7, and we were all studying together. So we had all over the walls were post-its and maps and flashcards on memorizing
absolutely
everything.
And our other roommate was Marcus Will, who works at Acadia in Chicago. It's really amazing how full circle this is all coming. As Adam said, yes, we would come home late night, and then we would have different things open, and so we would sit around and taste and compare, and we would share with one another what was going on in the restaurant or the bar. And it's like, well, what do you think about this? I'm thinking about pouring this by the glass. Or Adam would be creating a cocktail, and he would have something literally brewing at, we had a bar, a built-in bar in the apartment. And, you know, that we would bounce things off of each other. It's like, what if he mixes that, you know, these ingredients together? So it really was like in 18th century, the salons, that's kind of what we were, you know, tapped into with the three of us. And then from there, we each had friends and, you know, different restaurants that were involved. The best ingredients being challenged the most. I mean, we had friends that worked at Alinea. Trotters, you have Adam at National 27 and, you know, his fabulous bar garden that he created. So it really comes from there, all these different ideas that we had.
It was kind of a melting pot. And if you look at an analogy to New Orleans, of the Seven Nations and certainly a great deal of influence here at Revolution, we were really kind of combining these other sommeliers and chefs who were our social network. And it just became a very creative melting pot to all of us wanting to advance what we were doing and learn new things and explore new flavors.
Oh, it must have been so much fun.
And it continued. We're lucky because it gets to continue, because he travels down to New Orleans for many different events. And because he was coming here 10 years ago, recognizing that this is an epicenter of food and wine and cocktail. And that's what's really exciting about it. So to have him come and we're collaborating on this, it's just coming full circle. It's very exciting.
Well, I know that Adam's down here doing a little new collaboration.
Yeah.
And so tell me, what are you all collaborating and creating behind the bar new today?
We're first getting a feel on what has been the most exciting, what are things that guests are kind of looking for, and just seeing how that it can continue to evolve and take it to the next level.
We're really focusing on as well is the spirits that are created by Chef Fulce, so the Retifia and the Cherry Bounce. We're very lucky. I think we're maybe one or two establishments throughout the country have these things available to them. And, I mean, Champagne makes Retifia, but this is very specific with Chef Fulce. I mean, it's passed down tradition.
Well, for people who might not know what that is, fully explain what that is we're talking about.
It really is brandy infused fruits. He also does it with camellia flowers that originally was done in St. Francisville, which has a really great story going back to a recipe that he got over from France that I think it dates back really to 1830s. Let's just say for sure the 19th century. And mm-hmm. then it was translated. I think the first time he made it was about 10 years ago.
Wow. I had no idea that he was such a cocktailian in antiquity.
Well, he really, and his perspective, when you talk to him about it, it's what he grew up with.
Uh-huh.
So he sees what's local and what's relevant, and then he's like, well, I got to do that. I got to make it happen. That's what I grew up with. As we all know, he's such a champion of living Louisiana and its culture, and then translating that into the culinary or the beverage side.
So give us an example of how you'd use that in a cocktail, Adam.
Well, a couple of different ways. And what's really apropos is yesterday I was at the Museum of the American Cocktail here in New Orleans. And there's a whole area of old manuscripts going all the way back to the 18th century with Retifia recipes.
Oh.
And so it's, again, what's old is new, and now what's happening in the cocktail world of the old way of doing things, where things were made homemade and from scratch and seasonal, is really coming back. And if you kind of think of Chef Fulce with his Retifias and his Cherry Bounce and whatnot, those are ways to preserve the seasons. And spirits are a great way to lock a specific fresh ingredient in time and then have that for the whole year. So it's a great way that you can have a flavor of let's take the Cherry Bounce, or he's done one with persimmon, that you would only normally be able to get for a small window of time, and that then pull that in with some other spirits. So because they are liqueurs, they can be used instead of, say, a simple syrup in a classic cocktail. So you can take something, for instance, a Collins. And Collins were popular back in the 19th century. You see them in Jerry Thomas's book. And it was simply a spirit and sugar and citrus and then seltzer or soda. And so you could pull something like a Cherry Bounce in as instead of your simple syrup with a beautiful gin and a little bit of seltzer and some fresh Louisiana citrus and taking a classic cocktail but making very specific to this particular place.
Well, you know, something that really strikes me about this is that there's been such a movement, and Adam, you've been such a leader in the movement of, you know, the bar farm, the bar garden, and seasonal and fresh. And this is such an interesting sort of a look back into time because of the preservation element that maybe in the dead of winter, you know, you want a little taste of spring that you can get because it's preserved.
Absolutely, yeah, like his orange. We have orange ratifia. We have orange ratifia and peach. And it's interesting, too, on this note, is that I'll have a cocktail made, and I'm like, look, I need more of blah, blah, blah. Well, darling, no, that's out of season right now. And I'm like, okay, we're changing the cocktail. So it really does work like that.
Uh-huh, that's fabulous.
It is fabulous.
Well, I want to change direction just a teeny bit. Why did you want to come here? And what does being in New Orleans mean to you, Molly?
I had always wondered what it was like here. My first restaurant job at the University of Iowa, I worked at the stateroom, and the chef was from Commander's Palace. And there is so much mystique around Commander's Palace in the service and the fine dining and being the marquee and the example. So for me to be able to come here and have it be full circle, it's really amazing. Not to mention we start talking about cocktails. And there is a living history here of the cocktail hour, of imbibement, of enjoying, and the je ne sais quoi that is alive here. It's not like this anywhere else, I don't think, in the world. So to be able to be a part of that and learn from it and live it and to be able to live it, I think is priceless.
Molly Wismeyer and Adam Seeger, a collaborative pairing at Restaurant Revolution. Louisiana Eats culinary heritage heroes are farmers, fishers, chefs, and food producers who bring an authentic taste of our state's heritage to the world's tables. This week's hero was born into a famous Cajun musical family with Louisiana roots dating back to 1765. Our hero grew up attending weekly family fete-dodos, where his father and uncles, the famous Cajun band Les Frères Michaud, often performed. In his early teens, our heritage hero and his brother began to regularly sit in with Les Frères Michaud, playing a variety of Cajun instruments and singing along in traditional Cajun French.
The thing about preserving Cajun French language, the music has always been a huge part because, you know, when people want to learn the language, a lot of them happen to be musicians, and either way, they listen to the music. But where do you start? You know, do you start with the music? Do you start with the language? And so when you hear it in Cajun French, you can say, well, I know what that is in English, so that teaches me how to say it in Cajun French.
After the devastating hurricanes in 2005, our heritage hero began to recognize how endangered the heirloom seeds of Acadiana had become. He began gathering seeds suited for Louisiana's steamy hot climate, like the longhorn okra, fathorn okra, and Zydeco Bear Violette, an exotically purple-striped green bean. While seed collecting, our hero also gathered medicinal secrets from French Acadian traiteurs. He learned that brilliant red mamou seeds could be steeped into a cough syrup that's said to be more effective than traditional drugstore brands. Our heritage hero began his own nonprofit organization, the Cultural Research Institute of Acadiana, whose acronym is CRIER, which means to cry out in Cajun French.
Our main mission is to collect and preserve all the heirloom seeds that have been in South Louisiana families for, in some cases, hundreds of years, whether it be through the Native Americans or the Africans or the French or the Germans or whatever seeds they brought with them into the New World. And so many of these varieties are still around and being planted every year by people but don't make it down to the next generation because, one, they don't need it because you can go to the grocery store and buy everything you need, and for two, there might not be one in the family interested. So we're taking it upon ourselves to collect samples of as many different heirloom variety seeds as we can and to grow them out and make them more widespreadly available in South Louisiana and just to continue those amazing genetics that are in danger of being lost.
That's why this week's Louisiana Eats Culinary Heritage Hero is Louis Michaud of the Lost Bayou Ramblers. Congratulations, Louis, and thank you for keeping alive the Cajun culture that is the source of real Louisiana Eats. We'll be back after a short break with award-winning documentarian Ken Burns. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Ken Burns' meticulous research guarantees PBS viewers new detailed information about our shared American history. When we discussed his work on Prohibition, Ken drew some fascinating parallels between the America of 1929 and the America of today. Now that you've immersed yourself in the time of Prohibition in America, how do you look upon that period?
Well, you know, the Old Testament says that there's nothing new under the sun. And what I was struck by is that how many similarities there were to that period, to our current political period. I mean, we were interested in the fun story and the deep, dark story of Prohibition, but this is the story of single-issue political campaigns that metastasize. This is the demonization of immigrants. This is a whole group of people thinking they've lost control of their country and want to take it back. This is the demonization of presidential candidates. I mean, everything that's going on now was going on back then, fighting over the issue of alcohol. And what we did is we divided our story into three sections. The first is the 100 years leading up to Prohibition. How did it happen? And then the second two are the mess that we got ourselves in. Americans, this is a land of rights, and this is the only amendment to the Constitution that limits human freedom, and the only amendment that was repealed.
You've said that Prohibition fueled the jazz age. Can you tell me how New Orleans figured in that?
Well, when you're talking about the jazz age, then you're talking about the home of jazz. Now, jazz was born in New Orleans out of a whole bunch of forces in the 19th century, and towards the end of the 19th century, it comes together. But what happens around the time of the First World War, just deciding to turn away from worldly affairs and more into more hedonistic pursuits. New Orleans is right up there. Jazz flourishes. It also occurs at the time when recordings are being made, so we can suddenly hear across the country this new music called jazz. So jazz happened before the jazz age, but I don't think it would have had that same beat or that same kind of illicit feeling, all of which fueled the jazz age. And you have to say New Orleans has got to be one of the homes.
Well, New Orleans is said to be the birthplace of the cocktail. So how did you find that we coped with Prohibition here?
Well, we learned that New Orleans was considered by many the wettest city during Prohibition. This is a law that made half the country lawbreakers, you know, half of American citizens lawbreakers. That's not a very good law. And a lot of people tried their best in certain Bible areas. They didn't drink already, or they were able to curb their habits. But in the big cities, filled with new immigrants, filled with tradition of music and shall we say, bawdiness, Wynton Marsalis would say, showing your behind, as New Orleans has, well, then a lot of stuff happened. And there's a famous story, probably apocryphal, about a prohibition agent named Izzy Einstein, who came to New Orleans and decided that it was the wettest city in the United States, because it took about 30 seconds after he got off the train before the cab driver, you know, pulled out a flask from underneath the seat of his car and offered him a drink.
Did you find that there were any changes that occurred in American food as a result of prohibition?
You know, I don't know that. Our whole country changed. Everything changed after World War I. We immediately enacted this, now in retrospect, ridiculous law. We began what we call the Jazz Age. It was a period of unbelievable, almost quantum leaps in almost every aspect of American life. Jazz represents a quantum leap in music. In classical music, Stravinsky was doing the same thing. In modern art, Picasso and others were doing the same thing. All of a sudden, we were not bound to the earth. We could fly. Everything was changing, and our tastes were changing too. Women's skirts were taking off and rising. Women's hair was being shortened into bobs. Young men and women were sleeping together, something they had not done in the Victorian age, all fueled by alcohol, all fueled by jazz. And one has to assume that going along with it is this birth not just of cocktails, but of food to eat just to keep you from falling over early in the evening.
What did you discover, if anything, about food that was being served in the speakeasies?
Well, you know, it was said that all you needed for a speakeasy was a bottle and two glasses. So it wasn't so much about food as it was about getting drunk, about getting access to this thing that the government, in its infinite wisdom, had decided to tell us we could not have. Now, 10% of the people have a problem with alcohol, and it's a huge social problem that we have to recognize and figure out some way to deal with it. But clearly, in historical retrospect, imposing a law on the remaining 90% as well as those 10% was not going to work. It created organized crime. Initially, what they were trying to get rid of was the saloon, which was a hated place of evil. And there's a funny thing in which we all say today, there's no such thing as the free lunch. Well, there was a free lunch. Quite often, if you were a bar, you serve free food, particularly salty food. And what did that salty food make you want to do is drink something. And there they had the beer and the whiskey and the rum and all the cocktails, and you drank. So you would go in and you'd be able to eat so long as you were keeping the liquor flowing too.
I heard that during Prohibition, amongst Italian immigrants, their tradition of winemaking went on fairly unabated, and that may have helped fuel a taste for Italian foods. Do you know anything about that?
I've heard that, and it makes a lot of sense, because quite often the Italians, because they had this ability to make wine, would also then serve it. Now, the Prohibition Act, called the Volstead Act, allowed you to make wine for your own consumption. If you sold it to anybody else, or you made beer or liquor, you were breaking the law. You could not buy it anywhere, so you had to make it yourself. So what happened is that people would make it, and then all of a sudden, particularly when the Great Depression came along, this was a way to supplement your income. You might be selling it to your neighbor, and then the neighbor would say, well, we've got some pretty good Dago Red, as they often called it. You come down to our neighborhood, and then all of a sudden somebody would be serving a pot of spaghetti. Boy, that smells mighty nice. And then the food would come out, and I don't doubt that a great translator of Italian food in this country was the prohibition of alcohol.
You know, I love to cook. That's one of the things I love the most, and I'm a huge collector of cookbooks. And I'm told that during Prohibition, housewives had to adjust their recipes because cooking wines were salted.
The craziest thing, I mean, this is the most hypocritical of all laws, and the government printed all sorts of different pamphlets of how you'd make cocktails without booze, how you could make certain food that depended on whiskey or alcohol of some sort without that. And people were supposed to make do, but of course they just kept pushing the boundaries of it and found new ways in an underground economy to continue to make those food. But yeah, the craziest things. The other thing, part of the hypocrisy, is that they would have things like bitters and hops and malt extract, and the malt extract you'd buy them in the grocery store, and it would have this large warning: do not leave in a dark room to ferment, otherwise it will turn into wine. I mean, they were giving you the instructions of how to make it, and so part of it is just the incredible improvisatory skill of Americans who wanted to still have their alcohol and weren't permitted by the government. They figured out ways around it.
Well, it was clear pretty early on that prohibition wasn't really having an effect on alcohol consumption. So why do you think it took 14 years to repeal the constitutional amendment?
First of all, it was an amendment, and that was the tactic of those who enforced this single-issue law. They knew that no amendment had ever been repealed, and so it stood a chance of banning alcohol forever. For a time, alcohol consumption did go down. Alcoholism, rates of alcoholism, arrests for drunk driving did decline in some areas. But then it was very clear that we had created a monster, that we had basically organized crime in America and created what we consider the organized crime that's with us to this day, that female alcoholism suddenly spiked. It had been modest. Women of the very wealthy drank a little bit at dinner. Women weren't permitted except whores in the saloon. So housewives sometimes drank vegetable compound, Lydia Pinkham's vegetable compound that was heavily spiked with alcohol and often suffered the consequences of addiction there. But all of a sudden, because speakeasies are unregulated, kids were drinking, women were drinking, and by the end of Prohibition, women and alcohol, there's a significant problem there. So many, many things. It took a long time. The self-righteousness of those in favor of it were certain that this noble experiment, as they called it, would work if only there was more enforcement. You know, we argue about unfunded congressional mandates. That is to say, Congress passes a law, but there's no money to pay for the enforcement. Well, that's prohibition, because this was passed by Republican administrations, the Harding, the Coolidge, and they were small government Republicans, so they weren't going to spend any money. There was more spent in fish and wildlife than there was on enforcement of prohibition, and we've got mighty porous borders and lots of shorelines and lots of people doing this. And so the laws got more and more complicated. They got more and more dark. Suddenly, in the end, they were strengthening the penalties. They were arresting the patrons as well as the owners of speakeasies. Basically, neighbors were responsible for turning other neighbors in. So it was just a bad law in every sense. And you can imagine the rejoicing when it finally lifted.
Ken, in the American craft cocktail scene of today, there has been a huge return to the speakeasy style of drinking establishments like Death & Company in New York and Bourbon & Branch in San Francisco and the Violet Hour in Chicago. What do you think this says about today's imbibers?
Well, you know, there's always an aspect of our popular culture which is retro, and every new generation thinks that it invented sex, that it invented drug use, that it invented breaking the law. And I think there's something incredibly sexy about prohibition insofar as the way Americans got around the law was by going into some place and doing things that traditionally had been done only by men in saloons, which were often called buckets of blood. And so I think there's some romance to all of those concoctions that took place during Prohibition as we were trying to figure out how to make that completely impalatable moonshine palatable. And we invented lots of cocktails, and now they're coming back. People have a lot of leisure time, and they're back to mixing their fruity drinks and all of these outrageous concoctions.
I just want to say thank you so much for talking with us on Louisiana Eats.
It's my pleasure. Let's eat.
That was award-winning documentarian Ken Burns. Consultant Rita Held has just finished an exciting new project. She's written the definitive guide for Angostura on cooking with bitters. Rita, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Thank you very much.
So tell me, what does Angostura bitters add to a recipe?
Well, I liken it to something like deep dark chocolate or dark roast coffee beans or orange or lemon peel that adds this depth and it kind of enhances and stimulates flavor in food. And it's kind of a similar flavor to those things, or toasted nuts. You know how you toast a nut to give them a deeper, richer flavor?
Yes.
That's what Angostura does to lots of different recipes, and that's what I've had fun doing.
Well, are the bitters actually used in cooking or as an accent after the dish is complete?
They are definitely used in cooking. Angostura bitters are a very concentrated flavor, and by itself is, I think, a bit much for most of our palates. I liken it to something like maybe fish sauce that you would never eat by itself, but you would put it in a recipe, and that's exactly how I use Angostura, in a recipe, in a sauce, a marinade, a salad dressing, tomato sauces, lots of wonderful combinations that are perfect for Angostura bitters.
I've heard that Angostura bitters can be used in the same way that we use hot sauce in Louisiana. Is that a fair comparison?
I don't think so. I know there's lots of different flavored hot sauces, but I would never compare them. That heat is what gives the spark to the recipes. With Angostura, the spark is this deep, rich, bitter flavor that I sort of liken to umami. Not that the flavor is the same, but that it enhances the flavor of food. You know, when you add a splash of soy sauce to stir fry, whoa, it's a whole new dish, and it's very similar to bitters in that respect.
So it can be used in every course from appetizer through dessert?
I would say so. I have not personally done too much with appetizers unless you say, for instance, I have a wonderful recipe with a lemon garlic shrimp that you could use as an appetizer. You could probably definitely use it in little meatball appetizers, pork, beef. It goes great with that kind of thing. So, yeah, I guess I would say it could go the full gamut.
It looked to me like the bulk of the recipes, at least that they gave me access to, were all sort of Caribbean and tropical. Do you have any uses for Angostura bitters that are just kind of plain old American cooking?
Yeah. For instance, one of the recipes you have is the marinated chicken breast. Now, that uses soy sauce and some sherry cooking wine, as well as bitters, and then a little bit of cinnamon. So that's not Caribbean at all, but it's just a really nice marinade that gives kind of a unique flavor to grilled chicken breast.
And what about beef?
Oh, yummy. I make great hamburgers that I mix in with, you know, how you would do a meatloaf, and you put a little egg and maybe celery, onion, that kind of thing. You put a splash of bitters or two, maybe a teaspoon or so, in that mixture, and then that's what you fold into the ground beef mixture. And it just gives it punch that you wouldn't otherwise have.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to give us this preview of cooking with bitters.
You're welcome. Try it in ketchup.
In ketchup?
I am a ketchup freak. I love it. And now I never have ketchup without Angostura bitters in it.
That's a great idea.
Yummy, yummy.
Culinary consultant Rita Held and cooking with bitters. With us as Adam Seeger describes how he builds new cocktails using historical Louisiana flavors. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Food blogger and Louisiana Kitchen and Culture magazine contributor Chris J. is our Louisiana Eats man on the road in the northwestern area of our delicious state. Chris, welcome back to Louisiana Eats.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor to be here, Poppy.
So where are you going to take us today?
Well, I want to take you into several kind of seafood plate lunch houses throughout Shreveport that serve a stuffed shrimp that is really unusual.
Stuffed shrimp?
It's a really unusual kind of stuffed shrimp. don't even picture in your mind the steam tray stuffed shrimp of anonymous cocktail receptions the world over. This is not that.
Well, what makes it so special?
Well, for starters, they look like corn dogs. They are the size and appearance of
corn
dogs.
They're jumbo shrimp.
They're enormous. They're served 3 to an order. And it bears pointing out that you can find them in places like Brothers Seafood, C&C Cafe, Sherry's Diner, African-American-owned plate lunch houses for the most part.
Yes.
They trace back to an extremely specific place and time in the history of the black population in Shreveport. There was a restaurant called the Freeman and Harris Cafe that opened in 1923 on Texas Avenue.
Wow.
And didn't close until 1999.
So it made it all the way through segregation.
Right. When it closed, it was the oldest continually operated black-owned restaurant in America.
What? Really?
So
in America?
We lost a jewel when it closed.
What a tragedy.
They actually have the historic marker still up on the original location that still says it's the oldest. Of course, it's been surpassed in that. But the shrimp themselves are these 10 to 15 count shrimp that are flayed, stuffed with a Creole crab meat dressing, rolled in a spicy dough, and deep fried hard. I mean, this is not health food.
They're crunchy.
Right, exactly. But what I love about it is all of these kitchens that prepare these shrimp, they were started and opened by people who used to work in the Freeman and Harris Cafe kitchen. So it's all offshoots of this one business that was like a tree of life for the black community.
That's a precious bit of heritage.
Absolutely. So you can't still visit this restaurant that played such a huge part in the role of the black community's political and cultural growth in Shreveport.
But you can have a taste memory of it.
Exactly. You can still taste the dish that made it famous. And I love that. And I always encourage people, especially if you're traveling on I-20, if you wanted to stop at Brothers Seafood, which is right off of I-20, grab yourself 3 stuffed shrimp. It's going to run you about $7.99, and they are going to knock your socks off.
Anything on the side?
Oh, absolutely. They're served almost like a meat and 3 kind of service. You're going to get to pick a couple of sides, whether that's red beans and rice or mock shoe or smothered collard greens. But the shrimp, honestly, you are not going to need anything else except maybe a slice of 7-Up cake or something from the counter.
7-Up cake. Now, that's an antiquity. So are they open lunch and dinner? When can you visit?
You know what's really interesting to me is that many of these places are open breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Because so many members of the community work in the area casinos,
yes,
and they're getting off work at 6 a.m., they may want dinner at 7 a.m. So you can wander into Brother Seafood at 8 a.m. and see people eating the stuffed shrimp all around you.
So who do you think has the best stuffed shrimp in town?
This is a bone of contention. You're going to get me thrown under a bus in Shreveport, but I'm going to tell you, if I had to only eat one place, I'd go to C&C Cafe. It's in a neighborhood called Allendale, which you've got to get off the beaten path. It's located near Shreveport Municipal Auditorium, which was home of the Louisiana Hayride. So if you're a music lover, you can check that out on the way. But this place is run by a woman named Connie Robinson and an assistant that she's had for 30 years that I only know as Kool-Aid. That's his name. But their stuffed shrimp are larger and spicier to me than any others in town. They're just flat out hot.
Yum.
So if you've got a taste for a burning tongue that will really do you right, C&C Cafe is the place to get these stuffed shrimp.
Well, you are just making me hungry for some stuffed shrimp. So thank you for giving us this inside scoop, and please come back and see us again soon.
I would be honored. Thank you.
Chris J., Louisiana Eats, Northern Louisiana roving reporter. Adam Steeker is all about local seasonal sources. Most recently, Adam helped develop some original but distinctly Louisiana cocktails for Fulce and Tremonto's Restaurant Revolution. So Adam, even though you had been very familiar with the cocktail culture and with New Orleans, I don't think there's a Tales of the Cocktail that you've missed personally, but when it came to being involved in an operation that was going on day to day here, were there new things that you learned about the drinking habits of this city or things that surprised you that you weren't expecting?
Well, I'm always blessed when I come down here to spend some time with Chris and Laura McMillan. Chris, to me, is a great mentor, but also just a living historian. And because of everything old becoming new and hot again in the cocktail world, it was great to spend some time with Chris. And one of the things that we had conversation over about 10 dozen oysters last night in a few hours was about an article that he found from the 18th century that mentioned a bittered rum sling. And a sling is basically grog. So to back up, you've got liquor, and then grog was liquor that you added water to make it a little bit more palatable, a little bit lower proof. A sling, you would then add a little bit of sugar to. It's basically a mojito recipe back in the 1800s. This particular one was 1780s. So it was really fascinating to kind of have that in one ear and then be over at the Museum of the American Cocktail and reading about Rotefia, and then coming here and spending a little bit of time just learning of what they're doing right now and giving them some fresh eyes and seeing all these Rotefias that Chef Foles is making, and sort of become a little bit of a gumbo in my head of connecting the dots and hopefully giving some ideas for where they're going to take their cocktails.
Any hints on suggestions that you're going to make, interesting flavor mixes that we can look for here?
Well, I think in particular, taking the respect of great classic cocktails and from there pulling in ingredients that someone can't get anywhere else. I think when you go to a restaurant, one of the reasons you're going is because there's an expertise or there's specific fresh ingredients that are not easy to get at home. And when you can have a well-executed cocktail that's familiar, even if it's a Collins or a twist on a margarita or whatnot, but it's made with something that's seasonal or an ingredient that's from the restaurant or mm-hmm. from the area you are at, I think that's what makes it really special. So what we're looking at are having things that may have an ingredient that is unfamiliar, but introduce it with a little bit more familiar cocktail base and give people something really special that is on par with what the food is here and certainly the amazing wine cellar.
So what's new in Chicago? Got anything exciting, new brewing that you want to tell us about?
Quite a bit going on in Chicago. We're very excited that Aviary has really put the Chicago mixology scene on the international map.
Tell us a little bit about Aviary.
Well, this is Grant Ackett's, and Grant has really just taken the both molecular cuisine to the next level, but doing it with an incredible respect to flavor and texture. And what I think where molecular has sometimes been confused or where it's been criticized is where form has been before flavor. And I can definitely say from dining at Nex and at Aviary and at Alinea that the flavor combinations are very classic, but the presentations are extremely innovative. So what Aviary is doing is they're taking classic cocktails, but they're doing them in absolutely breathtaking presentations. For instance, you'll have an old-fashioned that is built inside of an ice cube that
wow.
then you break at your table with a little miniature slingshot. So at the end of the day, it's a great brown spirit cocktail, but the ice is done differently than you'd ever see.
It's a drink and a game.
It really is. I think people love to play with their food. They love to play with their drinks. And there's a gentleman in Chicago who is doing some neat things with the folks at Nex and Aviary, Rod Marcus, who is a master blender for rare tea cellars. And really, certainly the go-to guy in Chicago, but really getting an international reputation as one of the top tea blenders, one of the top go-to guys for sourcing rare botanicals. And what's been fun with kind of crisscross in this business is I've been able to spend some time with Rod in the last 10 years of buying his ingredients to use in bitters and use in cocktails. And now we're starting the first bitters company in Chicago to actually create cocktail bitters with these wonderful rare botanicals. So
congratulations.
Thank you. There's some exciting things down the road. We've got lots of mason jars with experiments, and next level is getting those in bottles and be able to have people use those behind the bars. And we're hopefully even have some chefs use them in the kitchen as well.
What would chefs be using bitters for in the kitchen?
Well, bitters are both aromatic and they also add that fourth flavor element, the bitterness that adds so much complexity and balance. And just like in a cocktail, a bitters would be like a finishing salt in the kitchen or an infused oil. The mixology world, we're pulling so much from the culinary world. I think one thing that's happened now is with this blurring and ambiguity and new inventions, especially at Aviary, for instance, that the culinary world is now starting to look at some of these things we're doing in the bar. So I think there's definitely potential of chefs looking at bitters. If you even look at something as classic as a Peychaud's or an Angostura, there are a lot of recipes that call for them that really enhance them in the kitchen. So we're hopefully going to have some, they'll take a little bit of our ingredients from the bar and it'll just keep raising the bar, as we say.
Adam, you see so much as you travel the United States. I'm curious what national trends you see that haven't quite started happening in Louisiana yet.
Well, I think some of the molecular uses within the bar, they're a bit controversial depending on how they're done, but when they're done well, they can be really interesting and exciting. And I think that'll be most interesting in New Orleans, where there's such a deep respect for the classics and tradition and history, and to be able to take something that is a classic and reinvent it, still with respect to the ingredients and the balance and the integrity, but perhaps in a new way that is going to add to a new texture or a new presentation that's going to get people excited about classic cocktails.
Okay, so this is going to be like the exam question. And if you want to say, just shut up, Poppy, let's go have a drink, I'll say, okay, Adam. How would you reinvent a Sazerac?
Well, the Sazerac is a fascinating cocktail because when you kind of dissect it, it's very close to the original cocktail, which was just defined in the balance about 205 years ago as spirit with sugar and bitters. And previous to that, it was called a bittered sling, because in the cocktail world, a sling is simply spirits with water and sweetened. And then if you add bitters, that was a bittered sling. That was kind of the original cocktail. And the Sazerac, where nowadays, generally you'll order Sazerac and it's coming with rye. Well, the original Sazerac was actually made with cognac, and it was named for the Sazerac Cognac Company.
And I like it that way better.
Oh, it's beautiful. Cognac is a wonderful spirit to mix with that really gets overlooked past the after-dinner snifter. Because cognac, of course, made from grapes, there's natural acidity in there, and that's something that is so important with both with flavor, but wanting to have that next sip when you have that natural grape spirit in there. So actually reinventing a Sazerac is almost going back to the original and going through not only what cognacs might have been available, but also looking at other grape spirits and reinventing it perhaps with an Armagnac or perhaps with an aged Pisco. Could be a really fun way of going back to the original, but adapting a great foundation of a classic cocktail with some other spirits.
Thank you, Adam. That was the hardest question that I could think of, and that was just the perfect answer. Thanks so much for bringing that breath of fresh air from Chicago, and come back soon, okay?
All right, cheers.
That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan & Company, Blightsegan and Westside Blightsegan Funeral Homes, LCI Workers' Comp, and our media sponsor, Louisiana Kitchen and Culture Magazine. Theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes, produced at Piety Street Recording. Thanks to producer and sound engineer Thomas Walsh and our editor, Zoe Sullivan. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO.